musical adventure. Lou will also be premiering her short film, Traveling I-5. Again, it's KBOO Artist-in-Residence Lou Watson and Traveling I-5, a sonic composition and film event at Jubitz Travel Center and Truck Stop, 10210 North Vancouver Way in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Bread and Roses has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Seattle Theater Group, presenting an evening with comedian Sarah Silverman performing at the Keller Auditorium on February 8th. Tickets are on sale now, and more information for Sarah Silverman at the Keller Auditorium is available at portland5.com.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this, and we have fun. We want our bread and roses, too. I'm Celeste Gurevich, the newest member of the Bread and Roses Collective, and tonight I will be sitting in conversation with Gigi Little, editor of the City of Weird anthology, and three of the featured writers. First up, bios and readings by said authors, and then we will get to the conversation. B. Frayne Master's literary leanings can be found in Airplane Reading, Monkey Bicycle 6, Hobart, Spork, and Mountain Man Dance Moves, the McSweeney's Book of Lists, and her book of short stories called Pants All Night. She is also the executive producer and host of the Backfence PDX storytelling series.
This is a section from my story in the book called Queen of Tabor. Minerva challenged Henry to skip from the Mount Tabor gate on Salmon Street to the foot of the bronze statue of the crusty old conservative on top of the hill. She immediately pulled way ahead, bobbing up and down in huge flying leaps, Henry's voice behind her echoing through the trees. "This is the last time I'm making my legs make this communist motion. You are a torturer." Minerva was laughing so hard at Henry's shouting, she had to drop to the pavement and crawl the final few feet to the Harvey Scott statue. She shouted back at him, "I beat you here, Henry Brooks. All hail the Queen of Mount Tabor." An ardent believer in sticking to tasks he committed to, Henry jammed his knees into the air one after the other until he stood over Minerva, dripping sweat on her dark, wild hair. Hunkering over, his hands on knees, Henry conceded, "You are my queen, and I shall refer to you forevermore as thus." Minerva's laugh turned to a solemn smile. The weed had just kicked in big time. She stared hard up at Henry. The moon shone through the pine trees above his head, casting branch-shaped shadows across his sweet, stoned face. It was then she was sure that this was the night she'd show him this special place. Lying on their backs in the middle of the park, not far from the statue, Henry said, "It's so groovy that Tabor is a volcano." He had no idea the industrial-sized can of worms he'd just opened. Minerva's grandmother was a volcanologist, and Minerva had lost many a friend and potential lover to droning on a bit too much about the specifics of cones and calderas, but she couldn't resist blurting out a few facts. Tabor was formed like 2 million years ago and is twice as old as Mount Hood. Suck it, Hood. And even though the scientists say it's dormant because none of its vents have been active for like 300,000 years, I've got it on good word that scientists don't actually know crap about it and when a volcano might just change its mind. I mean, did you know that Yellowstone is a supervolcano and erupts every 600,000 years? And because it's a supervolcano, when it does erupt again, it'll wipe out a large portion of North America? As her fax rant trailed up and into the night air, it met up with all the other words being spoken by all the other people of the world. Minerva's eye caught a squirrel swinging between two trees. She rolled onto her stomach and spread her arms wide, digging her fingers into the dry August ground. Barely audible, she said, "Hug the volcano with me, Henry. Your queen commands it." Henry dutifully hugged Tabor. "Can you feel its heart beating?" Minerva asked. "Not really," Henry said. "Don't be afraid to have an experience, Henry." And I'll stop it there.
Lee Ann Kronz is a writer living in Portland, Oregon. She earned a degree in environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, communicated with lowland gorillas using American Sign Language, played guitar in an all-woman rock band, and is presently involved in mental health enrichment work with Asian elephants. She is a producer with KBOO Community Radio's Between the Covers book program and our very own Bread and Roses Feminist News and Public Affairs Collective, the longest-running feminist radio program in the country. She is currently writing a novel.
My story, Orca Culture, is told from two alternating points of view. A pod of orcas trying to survive in a toxic ocean, and a human female trying to find a way to live in a toxic culture. So tonight I'll read from the human female's perspective. She stood on the sand, a surfer watching the approach of radioactive waves. The nuclear plume was due to hit the West Coast that year. Seattle first, then Portland's backyard. It had already hit her. She was the human at the end of the story. She was the voice no one wanted to hear. She had been fired from KPDX for talking about it on the air. The mainstream media ignored the first reports that trickled in across the wire, as if what happened to the ocean would not rain down upon the city. Life proceeded as normal on the Oregon coast. Families arrived like the carnival on weekends, colorful umbrellas and screaming laughter. She didn't really want to tell them. She wished for them their bonfires, soaring kites and perfect waves. She set the alarm for sunrise. How many she had squandered. She woke to the patter of mist on the windowpane. The ocean was a ghost. She walked along the lace hem that appeared and disappeared on the wet sand. She could make out the smudge of a person up the beach, coming closer. A man. She recognized him. He was a famous writer of the Portland Literati, who rented a house in the three-street town. His wife and children joined him on weekends. Weekdays, other women. He wasn't friendly to her, a witness to his deeds. When she first moved in, he knocked on the door with red wine and two glasses, invited her to sit on her own deck, began to explain the view. She had asked him to leave. His books made her wince. Male privilege run amok. The writer materialized out of the mist, glowered in passing, and was enveloped again. And you have to buy the book to find out the terrible thing that happens to that guy.
Susan DeFreitas is a writer, editor, and spoken word artist. Her fiction, nonfiction, and poetry has appeared in The Utney Reader, The Nervous Breakdown, Southwestern American Literature, Fourth River, Weber, the Contemporary West, and Bayou Magazine, among other publications, and in 2004 her work was a finalist for a Best of the Net Award. She is the author of the fiction chapbook Pyrophytic and holds an MFA from Pacific University. She lives in Portland, Oregon, where she serves as an editor with Indigo Editing and Publications. Her current book, Hot Season, was released on November 1st, 2016 by Harvard Square Editions.
All right, I'm going to read from my story, The Mind-Body Problem. Here's a few things to know before I get started. The protagonist of this story is named Shayna. She is a student at Reed College, and she is in love with her best friend, Cam. Cam is in love with a girl named Sarah Lynn Rose. Sarah Lynn Rose presents as very feminine, very femme, and Shayna presents in a way that is pretty masculine, but really more as a form of camouflage than anything else. And Shayna, at this point in her life, has developed an eating disorder of which she is unaware. There was a bathroom through those big double doors and downstairs, down the hall from the classrooms where I sometimes had seminar. I found it and pushed into a stall, as it turned out, just in time. After my stomach had rid itself of its contents, I felt better but also dismayed, forced to flush away everything of any consequence I'd had to eat that day. I sat there for a while, the bird's nest of my head in my hands. Ever since I'd come to this school, I'd had this feeling like I couldn't connect with anyone, except for Cam, who'd felt from the first like an old friend, a kind of shadow or second self. Where was he? When I stood, finally, and unlatched the door, Sarah Lynn Rose was fixing her makeup in the mirror. "Oh, hey," I said, all fake cheer as I stepped to a faucet. She favored me with a half smile. "Hey yourself, having fun at the party?" I shrugged, wondering exactly what she meant by that. "Did you check it out?" "It's Tuesday." I just blinked, like, what did that have to do with anything? Wilder and I were actually trying to study. Wilder, the lanky blonde in our class. So that was who among the multitudes she had chosen. The rest she'd simply dismissed, as if their longing had nothing to do with her, despite the kind of clothes she wore, that fitted V-neck that drew the eye inexorably to her breasts, those slacks that hugged her ass. At 18, Sarah Lynn Rose was the sort of girl who was already a woman, an East Coast sort of type A who'd no doubt go on to law school, make partner before 30, and for fun, master Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Even her feminism, in a way, was better developed than mine. She seemed to understand, at least, that the strange action her body exerted on others at a distance was not necessarily her responsibility. I stood there at the sink, hating her, even as I kept on smiling, in part because I could sense that she did not necessarily hate me. Like my best friend, the boy I loved, I was simply, for the most part, beneath her notice. I cleared my throat softly, hoping to come off casual. "Any chance you've seen Cam?" And just for that moment, the eyes of the idol softened. Shayna. I had that light, bright, dangerous feeling again, like I was floating. "Cam is with Alex, shooting heroin in his room. And you?" Sarah Lynn stepped toward me and took hold of my wrist, the way an owl might take hold of a mouse, and lifted it up between us. "You need to eat."
Welcome to Bread and Roses, and thanks for joining us.
I'm your host, Celeste Gurevich, and I'm thrilled to speak with tonight's guests, four immensely talented women representing the smoking hot new anthology, City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales. Now in its third printing, City of Weird has been featured in Portland Monthly, The Oregonian, KTU, OPB's Think Out Loud, and Between the Covers on our very own KBOO Portland Community Radio. City of Weird has also been chosen as a Pacific Northwest Independent Bookseller Bestseller and a Powell's Books Bestseller, as well as their Pick of the Month and Pick of the Season. Two quick quotes about the book. Jess Walter, author of Beautiful Ruins, said, "If weird makes you think of funny and moving and disturbing and just plain odd in that wondrous Portland way, well, City of Weird is the book for you." Monica Drake, author of The Folly of Loving Life, said, "With work ranging from myths to folklore, science fiction, and a surprising comedy of eco-feminist post-Fukushima revenge, Gigi Little has collected together a brilliant showcase of literary talent working in the Pacific Northwest." Joining us in the studio are editor Gigi Little and three of the featured writers, Susan DeFreitas, Leanne Kronz, and B. Frayne Masters. Thank you for being here and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would love, Gigi, first of all, to hear about your experience putting this collection together as a female editor dealing with genres that are primarily male-centric.
Well, it worried me, actually, because once I put together all the stories, there are 30 stories in the book. There are probably half male, half female written. Once I put them together, I organized them into parts, into sections. The first section is called From the Deep. So you got, sea monsters and things there. Second section is From the Skies, so you got aliens and birds and things like that. So I was working with theme. And once I got them all together and I was sort of ready to go, it suddenly occurred to me that the first whole section was just all women. Mm. It was all written by women, all women protagonists. We had lesbian love story. We had an outright feminist story. I mean, there's so much of it in there that was female-centric that it scared me a little. I actually went to publisher Laura Stanfill and I said, hey, you know, maybe we should, you know, change this up, maybe flip it, you know, so that the Skies comes first. And she said, absolutely not. I told her why. Yeah, I told her I was afraid that, you know, it is a stereotypically male-centric genre,
yes.
Weird fiction is. Yes. And I worried that, I would sort of alienate part of the audience. And I wimped out a bit, and then she brought me back from the brink.
And what's ultimately been the response to that? Have you found it a favorable response that have people noticed?
I don't think nobody has said anything. Once in a while, I will talk about it because I find it interesting. Nobody has said a thing about it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they just talk about the stories and which ones they like and awesome. All that. So
that is awesome.
Yeah. Well, is that a good sign or a bad sign?
That's a great sign.
I think it's a great sign.
That would work.
Just that people take it for granted that it's just writers, not female-male writers, and that they don't notice that distinction?
I think not take it for granted, but, like, it's good writing. Mm. So they take it for awesome, right. As is.
Exactly.
All right, so a question for you, Leanne. And it's Leanne, because I know trying to get your last name right, I put your Leanne. It's a crazy name. It's okay. So my question is the beach town in your story an amalgamation or a real place?
It's a very real place. It's where I go to write, mm-hmm. to get away from it all, and I'm not going to tell you where it is.
Oh, no. Keep it.
So
don't
sorry.
Disclose.
It's so special. And it's one of those pristine natural beaches with, like, old growth driftwood, and I don't want it to be spoiled, and I have people who would be very mad at me.
You want to keep it a secret.
Yeah.
No, that's great. I love that. I asked that question because it's a really great thing in the story, because as somebody who grew up on the Central Oregon coast myself, I couldn't tell if it was an amalgamation or a real place. And it works as either thing. And I liked the mystery and how that played out, where you kind of, as a reader, you play a guessing game of like, oh, is that Manzanita? Oh, wait, is that, yeah, I don't know, but it could be. So excellent, thank you. All right, Susan, I really resonated with what your protagonist character had to say about how she uses clothing as protection and camouflage from men, and also the competitive emotional dynamics between young women, most specifically in college age. How did writing this story help you to connect or reconnect to your own feminism?
That's a great question. You know, I am the daughter of a feminist, and so growing up, I always thought, hey, I can dress however I want to. And most of my friends in high school were boys. That's reflected in the story that I wrote, The Mind-Body Problem, which is set at Reed College and is based on some of the time that I spent there. But I thought that I dressed the way that I did, like my guy friends, because I was a feminist, right? Because I didn't need to emphasize, the contours of my body or my young sexuality by wearing clothes that fit. I wore, baggy pants were in style at the time, and kind of bigger shirts. Those were what my friends wore. But you know, the perspective of looking back in writing the story, I realized that it wasn't just because I was expressing this full spectrum of my my disregard for gender through my clothes. That's what I thought at the time, but that wasn't exactly it. I wasn't just wearing those clothes because they were comfortable. And I wasn't just wearing those clothes because that's what my guy friends wore. I was wearing those clothes because the young female body attracts so much attention. And we use this term, the male gaze, and it's definitely, I've gained the language now to say, oh yeah, this was part of how I was deflecting the male gaze. But, it was also, I was just deflecting every gaze. Because I did not want my body to be what people judged me by, right? Another thing that we do to young women is that we fetishize their beauty to such a degree that a young woman who wants to be an intellectual, who wants to be a writer, wants to be known for what she thinks, almost has to make her voice and her work louder than the way that she looks.
Amen.
Right? So I guess I realized through the lens of this story that the way I was presenting at that time was not exactly as feminist as I thought it was. It was, in fact, a form of camouflage.
And was it easy for you to forgive that young woman for her misperceptions?
Oh, I love that young woman.
Her.
Embrace
that.
And young women like her everywhere. I still don't think it was an inadvisable thing to do at all. Once I was out of school, once I had gotten, my degree, I'd had a job in my field for a while, I felt like I could wear femme clothing. Why? Because I now had something to stand on, right? I had what I felt like some authority to be taken seriously. Whereas, at a cute young thing at 18 years old, you have nothing to stand on, but your own sense of the gravity of your ideas and the importance of what you want to do and what you think. So I think it was a strategy, but I'm happy to be able to wear whatever I find attractive at this time in my life.
Nice. Excellent. Well, thank you for that. All right, Frayn.
Yes.
First, I think I want to ask you, not a question that I wrote down, but where in the world did you learn to be so funny? Have you always been absolutely hilarious?
You have to have oppressive Catholic parents. So if you didn't have them, I'm sorry. But I don't know. I think it's just, I really truly was a child that was not of my parents. Mm-hmm. And my next door neighbor lady actually was quite good about fostering that in me privately without my parents' knowledge. She kind of got me in a way that they didn't. So it's weird. Like, I think about her a lot because she really tended to that side of things. And she was Episcopalian, you guys. So naughty. Like, for instance, her daughter was several years older than me. And when I was 12, they took me to see Rocky Horror Picture Show, wow. Which to this elementary school Catholic girl blew my mind wide open. Seriously, it was the first moment where I was like, oh, okay. There's something else going on. Yeah, and it was so exciting, that moment when, I'll never forget that, you know, the elevator, everybody knows the scene when Tim Curry's coming down the elevator and he's tapping his, she's tapping. It was just like, I was like, that tapping is still, I can still feel it in my body. That's how impressionable I was, or how impressive it was, or it made an impression on me.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, yes, from a fellow Tim Curry worshiper since the day. I totally appreciate that.
Yeah.
But I asked that because your story, I laughed out loud during your story that I think reading it on the porch, my neighbors thought I was insane. I think that they literally thought I was losing my mind because I was cackling at the dialogue and just your descriptions. And
You need to get some Episcopalian neighbors who understand you.
They sound very subversive. I like that.
I want to say that Gigi, as the editor, was an amazing editor on this book. I think had a really keen eye for, like, there are just so many things as a writer that somebody can just say, like, give this breath or take this away. And it just, it matters when people are reading it. And there was a couple of the jokes, which I feel like she really helped me space out really nicely so that there was a breath and then there was a, you know, then it could have, it had a stronger punch to it. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated that a lot. It was really nice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was great.
Oh, a fantastic answer. I do want to get back to that. I was going to ask you all, and I will, how your experience was with Gigi as an editor.
That was my only good experience.
She's great on the humor. She's good for the humor. Yeah. But she made me cry with everything else.
Yeah. Gigi Little is not like the name that I think. No, I'm kidding. Like, it's such a friendly name. I was going to try to make some joke about how, you know, the Iron Fist. The Iron Fist of Gigi Little.
Well, I'll come back to my question, but on that note, I do have to disclose that I was lucky enough to attend Tom Spanbauer's Dangerous Writing Workshop for a year and a half with Gigi, and one of the things that made me such a ridiculous fangirl instantly of Gigi's work every week was her ability to do that very thing, to be so slangly funny that you're laughing out loud and then give it a breath, and then she steals your breath with that kind of heartbreak that comes after that. So I love that you felt that experience as an editor with her.
Yeah, it's the best.
Thank you. I'm going to hide under the table now.
So, Frayn, my question for you.
This is the real question.
This is the real question.
Okay.
The other is just kind
of... it's a doozy.
Lovely asides.
Okay.
You mentioned in prep for this interview that the female protagonist in your story may be, and I say big may, quote, fashioned in the spirit of the real-life sister of the statue that sits atop Mount Tabor, Abigail Scott Duniway, and who was, and for those of you who don't know, the first woman to register to vote in Multnomah County. And so I just was fascinated with the process of writing your story and how that might have come about for you to explain.
Well, originally when I was writing my story, I'd always had the idea that it would be some teenagers on Mount Tabor because I live right by Mount Tabor. So, and at first I thought that they would be swimming, that it would be sort of a Jaws takeoff, and they would be swimming in one of the reservoirs, and there would be a shark in there. I don't know. You guys, it's good I dumped that idea, really.
Good idea, too.
Did you really?
Oh, my God. There's
going to
be a shark.
That's hilarious. Yeah. I love it.
There are so many aquatic monsters in this book.
Right.
You know?
And you had told me that, so that was good, because it shifted me away from it.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'll play off the more, you know, the volcano aspect of it. And so I started reading about volcanoes and then freaked myself out a lot about the super volcano in Yellowstone, which really will. Yes. And it's been 600,000 years since it blew up. So it's supposed to blow again. Yeah. So I don't know. There's something to look forward to. So making it a volcano, I wanted some of the scenes to take place on the very top part of the Mount Tabor, and there's always been that statue there, that Walter Scott statue, and I've always been like, what is that statue? Who is that bronze fellow up there? And then I started reading about him, and it turns out he's this total a-hole. He was the editor of the Oregonian, and he was really like, he didn't believe in public schools, and terrible. And then in contrast, he has his sister Abigail, who like started papers against him, she just like, they just fought like in this really awesome way, and she was a suffragette and everything. So anyway, I think I was reading that, and as I was thinking about these teenagers, I do think that Abigail's just kind of by osmosis, if that's the correct way to use that term, probably not, but anyway, let's pretend it is. And it just seeped into me, and like there was just these choices that I made for Minerva, who's the lead character of my story. Just choices I made for her that, it's so weird that in 2016 that, we're still concerned about, like, it's all women top loading a book, which is just something we're concerned about. And then also that I could make jokes based on that same sexism trope that's still there in the book, just by making the woman be this thing that normally the guy is, in a heterosexual relationship. So it's just funny that you can still make those jokes and they still work. It's like, we're almost to the point where male nurse is just like an accepted thing, but it's still, people still like still. Male nurse, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. It's like, what, is that still a thing? When did we get over that?
Well, we're on the cusp of that, I think, but those, those old traditional ideas and...
How long is a cusp?
Yeah. How long is a cusp?
Hopefully in our respect, not too terribly much longer.
I hope so.
Yeah. Mm. Well, we're all helping to push that cusp as hard as we can. I know this. So I would ask then, I'll return to the question about Gigi Little as an editor. Let's put Gigi on the spot for a second.
Gigi on the spot.
Gigi on the spot. And so, Fran, you mentioned something about it already. So I will give it over to Leanne and ask about how your experience was with Gigi as an editor for your story.
Looking back, the first version that I submitted, it feels like an outline. Mm. When I look back on it, because she really gently drew it out over that year of editing, made me put in some things that I was kind of in my head. And she made me, of course, the Spanbauer influence. She made me root it in my body a few times. Mm-hmm. So it was, I feel like her name should be next to mine, and I'm not exaggerating. Like, she really drew it out of me. And her editing technique was so kind. Mm-hmm. I use this a lot. I tell people this, that, I would have these glaring issues in my prose, and she would call them bumps. Oh. I bump here on this, and it was just, never once did, that thing in me flare up, that artistic thing, that ego. Never once did she rouse that.
Wow.
Which is saying something for an artist, And the fact that she did it with 30 of us.
Massive.
I know, you're gifted. You're a natural, Gigi. It was just a pleasure, honestly.
Oh, it's lovely to hear, because it was very, I was nervous about being an editor, especially for, that many people, and having not edited a book before, having only done that kind of thing in workshop. And so one of the reasons that I took it on was that I wanted the experience, because I thought it would help me as a writer and help me as an editor of my own work. And I tend to, and I think this might be one of those sort of stereotypical female things. Mm-hmm. I tend to be such the nice guy. I've taught myself to be such the nice guy that girl. That when I'm in front of you, if you're in my workshop, it's very hard for me to notice the bad stuff, it was much easier when I'm reading it, and you're not in front of me, and then I can go through and kindly, pull things apart. But I was afraid that I'd get there and I'd have a bunch of cool stories and be too nice to edit them. You know, it's nice so to hear that you can be an editor and be nice about it, you know.
Yeah.
It works. And, you know, I always want to say back to Leanne that I don't accept that your story was like an outline. My explanations for everything, if I had a bump, which is a Tom Spanbauer term, by the way, I can't just give it to you in a sentence. I'd write like two paragraphs on, and then she would go back and intricately carve out one word or something. And I would be like, well, maybe, and I'd be thinking it through. How would it work best? And maybe she'll do this. Maybe she would just carve this little thing off, like working with a scalpel. You know, that's all she'd have to do, and it would be perfect. So
wow,
yeah,
thank you.
So Susan, your experience with Gigi as an editor with your story.
You know, I believe all I got was copy editing on this story. Mm-hmm. And that made me feel good about this piece, which I had put quite a lot of effort into before sending it out. But I was happy too, because I'd had this story in mind for quite a while. And the way it came about was that I was, I'd been a reader for Tin House for a while. So I was one of those people who would just kind of lurk in the back of the lecture hall during the Tin House Writers Workshop, that wonderful week in the summer. But of course, the Tin House Writers Workshop takes place on the Reed College campus. Mm-hmm. And that place is so fraught for me because of what I experienced in my one semester there at 18. And I had studied a little bit with Jess Walter at Pacific University. And I was just walking out of the lecture hall, and Jess was nice enough to come up, talk to me, make small talk, whatever. And he must have just seen the look on my face. He would describe it later as saying, I had the look of someone who has wound up standing by herself in the kitchen at a party at her ex-husband's house. Oh. It was exactly that, right? And I described to him, you know, kind of how I was feeling being there. And he said, you know, you have to write about this. Mm-hmm. But it was so fraught for me to approach the subject matter that it was a little too hot to handle. And I, of course, was working on a book and, you know, didn't have time to mess around with the short story. But then Gigi's call for submissions for City of Weird, I thought, gosh, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it, right? Mm. So I kind of wrote this piece for this book, mm-hmm. right? Even though it had been rattling around inside me for quite a while. But at the same time, it's such a risk to do that for an anthology, right? Because if they don't like it, where are you going to place it?
Especially for one as particular as this one.
Yes, right? And so, Gigi, when you wrote back, and I believe you actually said that it made you cry.
Oh, it totally did, yeah.
And that, you know, this was before I'd published my first book. This was... Huh? I think this is one of the first short stories I'd ever gotten published. And so that was, I had never had that kind of experience before, where something that was so strong emotionally for me appeared to actually travel through the words into someone else's heart and matrix. It was, and continues to be, just something I'm very grateful for.
Well, like, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, this book is, you know, on the surface, you know, about monsters and ghosts and hauntings and things like that. But, you know, listening to you talk, and Susan and Leanne also, when you were talking about your story, you know, it's, some of these stories are about our personal hauntings, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think I can totally that just comes off the page, Susan, in your story, you know. Mm.
Yeah. Very cool. I also have a question, Susan, that's a little bit of an aside. It's a bit like Leanne's question. So there's the thicket, the special thicket that you'll have to read about in Susan's story. That's this amazing, magical place on the Reed campus in Reed Canyon, which is actually one of my favorite sacred places in the city for many different reasons. Is that based on something real, or was that just part of the story that spun out?
It's absolutely real.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool.
And, you know, I am really more of a person who collages the real together to make fiction.
Oh, wow.
And it's kind of fun because, you know, oftentimes the people who would recognize all of the true things in a story will never read it. Because they've passed from our lives. You know, I guess there's, you know, if they're not on Facebook, are you ever going to, like, some of these people, like, did you ever even know their last name? It was something that took place 20 years ago, right? But for those who know, you know, they'll recognize that virtually everything in that story is true.
Wow. I'm always fascinated.
And it's a speculative story.
Well, sure, but I'm always fascinated when somebody can take nonfiction of their lives and weave it into a fiction piece that you literally have to ask that question because it occupies that space in between where it's both personal and universal in that really beautiful way. So I love that that's a real place. I promise I won't go looking, you know, for evidence.
Well,
but.
You know, even the speculative, I mean, the thing at the heart of my story is a book that does not exist. Right? It's a magical book. It's a somewhat haunted book. If you see this book, if you find this book in the Reed College Library, chances are you're headed somewhere that you would rather not be headed in your life, right? But even that was based on a dream that I had that was in the Reed College Library.
Oh, wow.
And but the dream itself was a little different. The dream itself, I mean, this may be a product of too little sleep, and the party culture of Reed College and foundations of Western civilization kind of conspiring together in the dream state. But I really did feel as if in this dream set in the Reed College Library that I found some forbidden knowledge about that I term split at the root, about some split at the very foundation, at the beginning of Western civilization that had to do with the split between mind and body, the split between man and woman, the split between head and heart. And so it's all in there. It's just through the looking glass.
Yeah, fantastic. Wow. Well, Gigi, I would ask this question. If you were submitting an anthology, you know, a piece for an anthology of somebody else's that was City of Weird, what would you have written about?
Gosh.
Since you have your own personal collection of beloved otherworldly monster science fiction-y scary things in your life.
Well, I have a story that I would have submitted, but I can't tell you because I'd like to submit it somewhere.
Oh,
but,
I asked the wrong question.
But that's a hard one to answer because I love all of those subjects, you know. I love an old-fashioned monster story, you know. What I did not get in here, maybe this is what I would do. Part of my description that I put out when I was making the call for submission, I said, you know, we're looking for, you know, this type of story. For example, and the first example I put out, which is not what is not the answer to your question, was the many tentacled beast that hides under the Burnside Bridge. But then my second was, the rip in the space-time continuum that is found at the back of Stark's vacuum cleaner museum. That, I think, is what I would write.
Yes.
That's amazing.
I went to that place on my last birthday, and it was fantastic. And I didn't get any time travel, and there's not enough time travel in this book. So that's where I'm going.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing that come out in some anthology coming up soon. Fantastic. Well, I also have to just relay a funny little story. When Gigi put out the call for submissions for City of Weird, we were still in Tom's workshop together, as were many of the people who were submitting. And so every week, because Gigi would come in about halfway through in the dinner break on her way home or on her way from work, there would be at least three people every week who would say, "Can I read my story first before Gigi gets here? Because she can't hear it because it's blind submissions." And so, which is hilarious. And then everybody would laugh and go, "Oh, yeah, sure." And, you know, Tom and Sage would roll their eyes and be like, "Yeah, okay." But watching the process of many of these stories starting out from, I mean, really skeleton ideas and first pages that were just kind of thrown together all the way through the process to the stories that you've curated here is truly an amazing thing. I mean, I am a huge anthology reader and, you know, literature geek all over, but this collection of short stories really does capture not only, like you said, people's kind of personal hauntings, the feeling tone of everybody's stories are melancholy and kind of gritty and really subversive in a lot of ways, which I love. But I'm in awe at how you would juggle the work of 30 people. It's such a monumental volume.
Yeah, it was a lot of people.
Yeah, I don't know how what the average is for, you know, the number of stories in an anthology, but 30 seems like.
Yeah, I my eyes were bigger than my stomach, you know, basically, and I couldn't stop. But, you know, I have to have that one. I have to have that one. And, your average anthology, I think, is probably like 16 to 20 or something like that.
Okay.
And, I mean, there are some pieces in here that are flash fiction, which I really like, short stuff. And so that helps. But yeah, it was a huge number of people. We went through three rounds of copy editing. Three. That's huge. Right. These people must have been so sick of me. Sorry, we have to talk about those hyphens again. You know.
Yeah. I'll just go to Europe next year. Just so many edits. Couldn't go.
So you essentially got to the number 30 just because you kept collecting so many stories that you wanted to include?
Yeah. I think I fooled myself into thinking that I had more space than I did. Like I took them and I tried to calculate from Microsoft Word files how many pages they would be counted, because I'm the graphic designer for 470 Press, which is the press that's putting it out, and so I have copies of all the books, and I've got the PDFs, and I can look through and sort of I try to do some math and calculate how many pages I actually had, and I calculated very, very wrong, and when I finally got to my 30 stories and I put them all together and I sort of calculated again. I thought, I thought Laura's gonna kill me. No, she said, "You got a vision. We're gonna go with it."
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It sounds like Laura's just been just absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Laura Stanfill rocks anyway in Forest Avenue Press. Yes, but for this particular anthology, like she just was a huge, open armed, open hearted.
She was like the perfect amount of support and letting me go. And whenever I, felt unsure about things or, and I would always, what do you think? And she said, "You have the vision. I want it to be your vision, And it was, so.
Wow, that's amazing. Nice. For your first opportunity to curate an anthology.
Yeah, it couldn't have been better.
Wow.
Could I ask Gigi a question?
Yes.
On something that she said earlier. You were talking about how you were reading through the submissions and you thought it might help your own work. And I'm curious about, after reading all those stories and editing them, were there any bits you gleaned from it just from looking at so many people's work?
It was interesting because I got a sense of the way other people edit or the way other people work. Like I was saying about Leanne, doing her fixes in a very kind of surgical way. It's nothing like I would do, you know, or would have done, you know. So now I'm going to take your style. No.
so many styles to choose from.
There are so many different processes. I got to know also through conversation, through the emails back and forth, how different everybody is processed as they build their books, and then how different their processes as they do their own editing work. And I think that, I couldn't name it off. Just I guess the breadth of it.
Cool.
Does anybody else have any questions for Gigi? I like this.
You guys take the mic and ask Gigi some questions. Or each other.
We have a few minutes left. All right, if nobody's going to take me up on that, I will ask the question about the cover, which I have been, I love this cover so much, and you have to see it. I'll describe it just briefly. It's a bridge. It's a very kind of a retro image of a bridge, and it's got a ginormous octopus on the top of the bridge, sort of wiling its way over and maybe down towards the river. And so Gigi dropped a little fact that I didn't know, and that is that the octopus is female on the cover.
Yep.
So would you like to talk about, my question was, did you choose that on purpose? Was that intentional? Or did you just find out after the fact?
I was choosing, when I was thinking about imagery for the cover, I was thinking, what's going to be, the most visual, the most interesting kind of image that I can use that harkens back to these old, wonderful Weird Tales magazines and pulp novels and of the 50s and 60s. So I was really, really drawn to, and I think that pretty much my decision was just, it was made as soon as I got all the stories, I had an octopus monster. how could I not use an octopus monster on the cover? And so, it's one of the early stories in the book, and the octopus's name is Emma, and it's a female monster, and I didn't think about it at the time. I thought, okay, I get to draw, an octopus. I get to make this thing. But it occurred to me as I was thinking about coming here and talking about, feminism and the woman's side of this story, and the fact that weird fiction is so stereotypically male, at least back in the day when it was really, really popular, that isn't that interesting that nobody knows this. When we if I was walking down the street and I saw a fox walking toward me, I would think it was a male fox. All the anonymous animals in the world are male to me, and I think they are to most people. Mm-hmm. And monsters, things of power, they're male. Mm-hmm. No, she's a girl.
Mm-hmm. or if they're not, they're Medusa, who turns on men with her snaky hair. Right. But she's actually a myth that that was actually a method of self-protection from Medusa, which most people don't realize. Wow. There were men coming to kill her, and so she turned them to stone in order to not be slayed by these men with these big swords.
Rebecca Solnit does that too, I think.
Oh, I'm ripping up. There you go. Rebecca, if you're listening. I may have inadvertently just ripped off a big sword. I just want to say again so much congratulations for the success of this book. There have been readings all over town. I mentioned a few of the publications and different entities that you've been covered by, but there have been so many readings around town that have happened, and readings coming up. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to actually include a couple of those as far as information. There are upcoming City of Weird events, and Tuesday, December 13th, is the most recent one, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Word Fest in Longview, Washington. And the featured readers will be Jason Squalata, Kirsten Larson, and Frayne Masters.
I'll be there.
She's going to be there. And the next is Friday, January 13th at 7:30 p.m. at our beloved American Legion Post 134 Northeast 21st in Alberta. And the featured readers will be Leanne Kranz, Susan and Frain, along with Sean Davis, Karen Monroe, Adam Strong, and Linda Rand. And then on Saturday, March 11th, from 1:30 to 3 p.m., at another read-through on North Mississippi, will be a reading, and Art Edwards, Jason Squamata, and Kirsten Larson will be featured at that reading. So get yourselves down to one of these readings and hear some of the words of the writers. It's going to be more amazing events, and I expect to see City of Weird reviews continue in all of our great major publications here in the Pacific Northwest. So thank you so much to Gigi Little, Editrix Extraordinaire of City of Weird, and B. Frain Masters, and Susan DeFreitas, and Leanne Kranz. I have been your host. I am Celeste Gurevich, and this officially ends my very first interview on radio ever. So
well done.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Be well and loved, beauties, and make sure to tune in next week to the next episode of Bread and Roses, Fridays at 6 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7. We always welcome new collective members, and if you're interested in joining us as a producer, host, or engineer, no experience necessary, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator, volunteer@kboo.org. You can connect with us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can access our podcasts and share feedback or show ideas. Like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. And we are on Twitter at Bread Roses Radio.
As we come marching, we bring greater days. The rising of women ennobles the race. No more shall we labor while the rich man reposes.
Good evening, Portland. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, all community radio, all the time. We've got Hard Knock Radio coming right up for you after these messages.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor the 3rd Annual International Human Rights Day, December 10th at 6 p.m. at the SEIU building in Portland. International Human Rights Day is a day of solidarity and remembrance of people all over the world who continue to be oppressed by human rights violations. Those who are systematically marginalized, disappeared, imprisoned, and killed. This event features a report back from solidarity trips taken to the Philippines in the summer of 2016, cultural presentations, and more. Again, that's the 3rd Annual International Human Rights Day celebration, December 10th at 6 p.m. at the SEIU Building, 6401 Southeast Foster Road in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 3rd Annual Stumptown Soul Holiday Spectacular on December 10th at 8 p.m. at the Star Theater in Portland. The Stumptown Soul Holiday Spectacular is a benefit and toy drive for the patients of Shiners Hospitals for Children in Portland. The concert and dance will feature performances by Ural Thomas, LaRonda Steele, Karen Lovely, Louis Longmire, and many more. Again, that's the 3rd Annual Stumptown Soul Holiday Spectacular on December 10th at 8 p.m. at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Another edition of Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we tackle key issues of the day. That's right, it's news, views, and hip-hop. All that and more coming up after the afternoon headlines.
Workers Independent News, we can review. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a major insult to working America, especially working people who voted for him, Donald Trump has chosen fast food CEO Andy Puzder as U.S. Labor Secretary. The National Employment Law Project says it's a sucker punch to the gut of workers. NELP's Christine Owens says it's hard to think of anyone less suited for the job of lifting up America's forgotten workers than Puzder. Owens says he's against raising the minimum wage, threatens to replace restaurant workers with machines,